Well, it's about time for us to start. Well, my wife's back with me today. Her and Alyssa were in Indianapolis last week, as I told you. And it was about 10 minutes till 6, I guess, last Sunday. I was freshening up to get back to services, and I got the phone call that said flights are canceled, storm in Chicago. And having a crying woman 1,000 miles away from me when there's not much you can do, it's a pretty tough conversation. But anyway, they finally got in about, 2 o'clock in the morning, and finally found a way home. But they're with us this weekend, and we're glad they're safe. We're going to be in Joshua chapter 3 this week. Joshua 3 and 4 are so inherently connected that I almost wanted to study the two chapters at the same time. But for a number of reasons, I've decided not to do that. I think there's just so much in Joshua chapter 3, and then there is so much in Joshua chapter 4 that we really need to talk about. And so we're only going to discuss Joshua 3 today. And you know, it doesn't get lost on me that the book of Joshua is a book that, you know, we've probably been studying. If you were raised in the church, you were studying it in Bible classes, you know, when you were just a kid. And so I don't necessarily think that the reading of the book itself is necessarily going to be particularly enlightening to you as far as new facts about the conquest. But hopefully as we look at that situation in the conquest, we can make some applications that might be beneficial to us or glean a few lessons out of that. And I do believe at the end of the day that God intended for the Bible to be practically applied and not just read. And so that's really what we're aiming for. Today we're going to be reading of the fact that they're ready to cross over Jordan. As a matter of fact, God's going to set that situation up so that they can cross over the Jordan. And so before we actually get to Joshua 3, the text, I think it's important for us to talk a little bit about the Jordan River and some of the characteristics of that river and really what they're up against so you can get a real feel of the context of the chapter. Now, we've had some good rain here over the last few days, and that's a good thing, as dry as it's been. But if you live here in the Woodlands, or if you travel into the Woodlands off of Greenbridge Drive or Upper Research Forest, what we generally see around this area are these little streams. They're not even creek beds. They're just streams that kind of meander the way under some of these overpasses that we have, particularly off of Greenbridge Drive. But when we get a goodly amount of rain, like we kind of had recently and certainly in times past, when you drive over that, you see how that water spreads out and covers the entire area underneath that underpass or overpass. And particularly, I'm thinking it out on Research Forest, where there's an area down there that when it rains and rains heavy, I mean, you would think that lake is, or that little stream is turning into something that's a mile wide all of a sudden. It's just from tree line to tree line. And generally out there, it's just, you know, kind of a little bit of a pasture land with just a small creek bed through it. Well, that's really kind of the picture that we see around what's taking place here in Joshua chapter 3. Now, and the only reason there's a better slide here, and we're going to look at a better map here, but I did want you to notice here that, I'm really good with this pointer. You'll notice right here just how not straight that line is, and so we're going to talk about that in just a minute here. The Jordan River is only, if you drew a straight line, the Jordan River is only about, it's just a touch under 70 miles in length. Starts up here in the mountains. There's four tributaries or some springs that feed it. And it's at a very high elevation. Mount Hermon is where it originates from. And just to give you a clue of the elevation and why there would be snow and the mountain ranges, from this point up here where Jordan River actually originates from Mount Hermon all the way down to the Dead Sea. Just that 70-mile stretch or so from end to end, there's a drop of 2,389 feet. So about a 3,000-foot elevation from where the Dead Sea is at up to where the river originates. And so it'd have the white snow caps that you would expect up there. And so in the springtime, when that snow and those springs and the rains come in, you can imagine the rush of water that comes down this 70-mile stretch of river. There's three principal lakes kind of associated with this. There's a Lake Hewlett here. From here to the Sea of Galilee in a straight line is about 10 miles. While we said there was a drop from Mount Hermon up here on the ceiling, you see my dad up here on the ceiling because Mount Hermon's up there. It's not on my map. It's up there. From there down to here is 2,389 feet. The drop from here to here is only 690-ish feet or so. And then the drop from here to the Dead Sea is about another 600 feet or 610 feet, actually. And so you see from Mount Hermon up here where the Jordan River originates, the drop is dramatic. You know, over half of the elevation takes place in a very short distance right here. It causes that surge of water. Now, you got to remember also back then, they didn't practice hydrology like we do today. They didn't have dams. I'm sure they had some dams, but they didn't have the sophisticated dams that we have today and so on and so forth. If you were to go over there today, you would find that the Jordan River is now highly managed by dams. As a matter of fact, a lot of the Jordan River is at a lot of danger up and down through here because of the amount of water they've siphoned off out of this area up here. And as a matter of fact, there's some dry beds down through here in the bottom end of the Dead Sea where all this water rushes down to and ends. Down here in the bottom of the Dead Sea, there's salt flats now. There's not even any water in there. And so the ecology has radically changed since the time that we read in Joshua chapter 3, the story that we're about to embark on, and what you would see today if you were there. There's two main, as we said, there were some tributaries up here in springs that feed this thing, but there's two main tributaries right here that feed into this, the Jabbok River, and you see Jericho here, about 20-mile stand, okay? Just about 20 miles from the entrance here down to Jericho. And because of all this lack of linearity, the Jordan River, rather than just, you know, I said if you drew a straight line, it'd be 70 miles. But without that straight line effect, it's about a 200-mile river. Now, I grew up around Vernon, as you know, and the Red River was right off to the end of us there. And I remember being on that thing in a flat-bottom John boat. And you couldn't look down the river. You had to go around curve after curve after curve. And that's exactly what's happening here as it relates to the Jordan River. Now, a lot of significance here. You know, there was Elisha, one caused an axe head to float in the Jordan River. Who was baptized in the Jordan River right up here? Well, it has the sweat of our Jesus in there. He was baptized right up here. John the Baptist was doing some baptisms right up in here. We believe that Jesus was baptized right up in there. I mean, it got holy water real quick, didn't it? You know? And there are still baptismal pools up there. As you can imagine, you know, the history associated with that. Those people are so proud of that fact and so linked to the Jewish religion, so linked to Christ, that there are still baptismal pools up there in that area. Okay, so that's kind of the lay of the land here. Let's take a look. Now, I mean, maps are fine, but now let's take a look and see if we can see something a little bit different around what we want to think about here. This is, and folks, it's going to change the demeanor of the landscape from here to here. It's going to change. This right here is a really highly fertile valley. I mean, highly fertile. And then coming out of the Sea of Galilee up here, not quite as fertile. And so you're going to see a change. Some of the pictures that we're going to look at here just over the next few minutes, you're going to see a pretty radical change in some of the landscape there. So here's like what you'd be looking at. And here you'd think, well, my goodness, the Jordan River, crossing the Jordan River. What is the big deal here? What's the big significance here? And by the way, the Jordan River, by and large, at any given point on any normal day, is about 3 to 10 feet deep. And I don't even swim, and I can make it. If it's just that wide, I'll get there. You know, I'll float on my back, and I'll get there. So you're saying, what's the big deal here? But there I'll give you a little bit of an idea of the landscape. But it, like I said, it changes as you go on down. Here's a picture. Now, I had to manage these pictures best I could because of the pixels as you spread them out. You can kind of see you have some distortion here. But I want you to look at the foliage along the banks here. And when you think of the Jordan River, I tell you what you need to be thinking about. You need to be thinking about lions and tigers. I mean, we're not thinking about the wolves and the buffalo here. I mean, they discovered all kinds of true wild animals around that area. As a matter of fact, there are certain species of animals there. About 40 species they identified. About 13 or 14 of them are only common to the Jordan River. And in the Jordan River, when it comes to fish, there are 27 species identified. 13 are only common to the Jordan River, found no place else in the world. And so a real specialized area. But look at the foliage here along the side of the river here. And when you think about the desolate land over there and the desert and how dry it is, you'll see why the Jordan River was so vitally important to individuals and why nations wanted to fight to retain their land around this area. Here's a bit broader view of the picture here, kind of the mountains there that gently slope in. So this wouldn't be the real fertile area, right? We hear about how the land was so fertile right around the Jordan River. But this wouldn't be the area. This is someplace on the river where it wouldn't have those characteristics. Once again, look at the foliage here. Look at the greenery. But look at how desert-ridden it is out past the river. This is near the entrance of the Sea of Galilee, so it would just be right north of the Sea of Galilee. Got a good clicker here. Once again, here's a view of the Jordan River as it leaves the Sea of Galilee, begins its trip down to the Dead Sea. And they think that the baptismal spot of Jesus is somewhere right here in this area, but, you know, who would ever know? I mean, it's been a couple of years. This is a picture of when the springtime waters are just beginning to flow, and now you begin to see a little bit of the rapids. You see a little bit of the widening of the river here, which is paramount to our text. And here you really see it at flood stage. And I don't know about that car, but I'm sure whoever's in that car is from Houston. Is it not true? I mean, we have a big rain. You watch the news, and somehow or another, that water under these overpasses that are 10 foot deep is a magnet to stupid people. Is it not? But I don't do this. But nonetheless, I'm sure this tourist here is right from Houston here, and he saw water, and he said, I got to get out there in it. But you can see kind of now what that water looks like as it relates to the Jordan River. Now, this is in the southern part of the river here, and I want you to look how beautiful and green and how fertile that land is. Oh, my goodness. You think that wasn't a prize in that old desert country? I mean, people loved this area right here, did they not? And you know, the river looks pretty tamed right there, right? But in the springtime, when this thing is out of its banks with all that snow and water and stuff coming down, it's over a mile wide. Now, not deep. I didn't say deep, but I said mile wide, and it's moving a little bit quickly. Don't forget that I told you about the drops, right? We're dropping 2,300 feet, 2,400 feet, and just from the Sea of Galilee down to the Dead Sea, we're dropping 600 feet. So we got some moving water here. I mean, we got some water here that if you're not very good, probably going to sweep you away, right? But look how beautiful and green that is. Now, this is further up the river. Once again, look how tame the river is. And look how the mountainous terrain is there and how desolate it is again. And here is a pretty good picture of early spring. It's still not the ferociousness of the spring, but you can begin to see the rapids in the river and the broadening of the river. And I think that does it. Now, of importance also is to realize not only do we have a river here that has some characteristics that represent danger, but we're not moving just the Woodland Oaks congregation across the river. That's not what's going on here. The best guess is that they estimated Israel to have about 2.5 million people at the time that Joshua chapter 3 was written. 2.5 million people. That's over half the size of the city of Houston. And brethren, we've got cars and highways, and in a hurricane, we can't get out of town. So you know what these people are facing. And on top of that, well, some people are not too smart and they do load their cars up with stuff they probably shouldn't load their cars up with. But I guess the point I want to make here is not only are there 2.5 million people here trying to get across the river, those 2.5 million people have all their livestock with them and all their natural belongings with them. They don't have no home. Their home has been in the wilderness for 40 years. Now, let me ask you a question here before we get right into the text, because I'm running out of time if I don't. I'm not asking for your age, okay? But some of you, I know how old you are, so don't lie. Got it? John F. Kennedy was assassinated, I believe, in 1963. So that means in 2003, that'd been 40 years. Right? And now we're 2009. How many of you were alive at some age where you can remember when John F. Kennedy was assassinated? That a long time ago, wasn't it? Does that sound like a long time ago? Does it feel like a long time ago? I was 10 years old. I can remember watching on the black and white TV set for 3 days that whole episode of his funeral and little John saluting his father. Remember that? But does that sound like a long, long time ago to you? Does that feel like a long time ago? It feels like a long time ago, doesn't it? Brethren, that's how long they wandered in the wilderness. The sense of time that you're feeling is the time that they wandered in the wilderness. Just to give you perspective, they were out there a long time. And now they're standing on the banks of Jordan. Everything they own, everything they have, everything they hope to have is with them. 2.5 million people. And we're at flood stage. And there's danger. And now you want to be in Joshua chapter 3 with me. Going to discuss a lot in the first 5 or 6 verses, and then from there we'll have to pick up speed because that clock's not going to stop on me. So you stay with me. In Joshua chapter 3, and if I had to entitle this chapter with a title, I would call it Stepping Out in Faith. Because while you think it's not about faith, I'm going to tell you, brethren, everything we do with Jehovah is nothing but faith. And it's nothing but about faith. And if you think it's any different, then you've missed the point and you've got issues and you need help. And I don't say that lightly. Everything related to Jehovah and every step of our life is about faith. And so Joshua chapter 3, if I had to title it, would be called Stepping Out in Faith. Read the text with me. It says, early in the morning, Joshua and all the Israelites set out and they went to the Jordan where they camped before crossing. After 3 days, the officers went throughout the camp giving orders to the people. You know, faith requires patience, doesn't it? They were there for 3 days thinking about it. And I know how these people are because these people are exactly like Dave Short. These people are exactly like me. God got me to the edge of the river and I looked at the river and I saw the width of the river and I thought about the depth of the river and I thought about my inability to swim. And I began to think about where could we get some timber to build something to get us across. I became an immediate problem solver, right? You ever get in that mode? I mean, I get paid for solving problems. Most of the people who are business people in this room, and even if you're in sales, right, your customer has a problem, what's your job? Solve a problem. I mean, we're problem-solving oriented people, aren't we? And that sometimes makes us dangerous when it comes to this concept of faith. Now, I'm not suggesting that we all just sit on the sidelines. We'll talk about that in just a moment. But I am suggesting sometimes we are a bit impatient, right? And we're presenting an obstacle that really needs a supernatural answer. And the best that we can do is think about it a little bit and come up with a natural answer that really doesn't solve the problem and usually doesn't take care of the situation. And so sometimes faith takes just a little bit of patience, right? Sometimes you just need to sit still. Matter of fact, I think there's a couple of scriptures somewhere that says sometimes we just need to sit still and listen to the voice of God. Right? And so here are people, 2.5 million, standing on the Jordan River, and here's what they're thinking. Man, Egypt looked pretty good. This side of the river looks okay. How come God chose today? What's wrong with another 40 days? Wait. Right? All that conversation's going on with these people. You know it is. They're not all sitting on the side. You say, well, Dave, how do you know that? They might have been inspired and really, really waiting on God. Brethren, I know these people. They've been complaining for the entire 40 years they were wandering. And they didn't stop just because they got to the head of the Jordan River. They're still the same blasted people they'd always been. Maybe a little bit better because Promised Land looks pretty enticing to them. But not all 2.5 million are happy to be there looking across that Jordan. Sometimes faith takes patience, brethren. Sometimes even in congregations, it takes patience. Even in congregations don't grow at the rate they should grow. Sometimes leadership doesn't get appointed as quick as it ought to get appointed. Sometimes it just takes patience to get there, right? Sometimes we just need to learn to wait on the Lord. And so that's what's happening here. For 3 days, they're sitting on the banks of the Jordan, wondering, probably complaining, but wondering what's next. Brethren, faith sometimes takes patience. That's not a bad thing. Keep reading with me, if you will. So after 3 days, the officers went throughout the camp. They gave orders to the people. When you see the Ark of the Covenant of the Lord your God and the priests who are Levites carrying it, you're to move out from your positions and you're to follow it. And if you were to read verse 6, it would say the same thing, when you see the Ark of the Covenant. And let me tell you something. If you were to do an honest reading of 3 and 4, chapter 3 and 4, at least 23 times, and I'm persuaded a couple more times than that, there's at least inferences, but at least 23 times, either by name or by pronouns of it, it says the Ark of the Covenant. Who's in the Ark? Now, what's in the Ark? We know what's in the Ark, the tablets, the stones, manna, so on and so forth. But who's in the Ark? What does the Ark represent? God's power and God's presence. God's power and God's presence. When you see it move, you move. When you see Him move, you move. Don't wait, you move. You get on with it. And so at least 23 times in those two chapters, it stresses that the presence of the Lord is near. And that when you see the ark move, you need to move. We're going to say more about that in a minute. Brethren, I promise you, when the Lord moves, that's the time for you to get on board. Right then, right there. Now, Ted Kell was one of my professors out at Sunset, and I love old Ted to no end for a whole bunch of reasons. But Ted, one day in one of our classes, was talking to us about God opening doors and closing doors. And I still didn't ever figure that out. And I don't even know if Ted had it figured out, but he was doing the best he could with a very difficult subject. Brother, I'm telling you, when God moves and He's opening doors, that's a good time to move. I mean, that's when you're going to move with the greatest degree of safety and confidence in your entire life, is when God opens doors. So just get on with it. Say, well, how do I know? Well, we're not going to discuss that now because that clock's moving, but that's a whole other subject. I mean, it's a difficult subject. But I'm persuaded there are some answers to that subject. Maybe one day they'll let me teach that. But anyway, in chapter 3 it says, when you see Him move, move with it. And then you will know, the last part of verse 4, then you will know which way to go, since you've never been this way before. But keep a distance of about 1,000 yards between you and the ark, and do not go near it. Boy, that's a powerful verse, isn't it? You follow it because you've never been this way before. You've never been this way before. Then you will know which way to go. I wonder when in my life, seriously, I haven't liked this lesson quite as well as I would have liked to have liked it this week. Because I really wonder in my life, really honestly wonder in my life, one of those points of meditation, of when I will trust God enough to let Him change my direction. Really, really change my direction. Not change my direction on occasion, but really change my direction. Because He wants to take me places that I have never, ever been before. Never, ever been before. When am I going to trust Him enough? I wonder, when am I going to trust Him enough that I just turn my life over to Him and say it here? Here it is. God, here it is. Go over to Ephesians chapter 4 with me real quick. Ephesians chapter 4 and verse 17. Interesting text. You know what it says in chapter 4 and 17 of Ephesians? Paul says something pretty witty here. He says, so I tell you this. No, I'm just not going to tell you this. I insist on it in the Lord. I insist in the Lord. I insist. that you must no longer live as the Gentiles do. In the futility of their thinking, they are darkened in their understanding. They're separated from the life of God because of the ignorance that is in them due to the hardening of their hearts. They've lost all sensitivity. They've given themselves over to sexuality, so as to indulge in every kind of impurity with a continual lust for more. You, however, did not come to know Christ that way. When am I going to trust Him enough to just totally let Him have my life? And if you were to read the rest of that text in Ephesians chapter 4, it says that a divorce needs to take place. You need to divorce yourself. And he lists about 7 or 8 or 9 things that I need to divorce myself from. And about 7 or 8 or 9 other things I need to marry myself to. The old self is gone. The new self is raised up. I wonder when I'm going to trust myself to the point, or trust God to the point, that I'm going to just turn over my life and say, God, here I am, and all the things that are a mess. And I know that we think we're doing that. And I'm not saying you're not doing that. But I wonder on any given day if I'm as serious about that concept as I really need to be. I wonder if I trust Him enough in this concept of a new direction to let Him renew my spirit. Have you ever read Ezekiel chapter 36? Well, I know you read Ezekiel chapter 36 at some point in time. But if you read down through there, Israel's about to come out of bondage because of their sin, right? They were put into bondage because of sin. Now they're coming out of bondage. You know what God says? I want to give you a new heart and a what? A new spirit. Do I trust Him enough to allow Him to renew my spirit? And have you ever read 2 Corinthians chapter 5 and verse 17? We are what kind of creation? A new creation. A new creation. Paul in 2 Corinthians chapter 5:17 wrote a commentary of Romans chapter 6 verses 1 through 10. He says the old man dies, baptism, and a new fella is resurrected, and we walk in what kind of life? Newness of life, right? But I worry about that a little bit. I mean, I know that's true. I know that all of a sudden from unredeemed to redeemed, I know all that's true. But when I get around to surrender and going places and letting God take me places that I have been resisting to for 55 years of my life just because I haven't been that way before. Just because I haven't been that way before. Now, I'm going to tell you right now, till I surrender, I'll never be the husband I ought to be. I'll never be the Bible-class teacher I ought to be. I'll never be the employee I'm supposed to be. I'll never be the father that God wants me to be. Never. Until I get enough faith, till I grow in my faith to the point where I decide to surrender, I'm never going to be what He'll have me be. And I'm never, ever going to go in the direction that He wants to take me. And I'm nervous on any given day about making that decision to do that. And we'll talk about why in just a moment. I mean, why don't we do that? Let's read a bit more here. Joshua told the people, I'm in verse 5, Joshua told the people, consecrate yourselves, for tomorrow the Lord will do amazing things among you. 2 points in verse 6. Consecrate, sanctify, make yourself holy. There was a guy named John Wesley that, you know, if you know much about religion, him and his brother Charles were big time theologians. And I don't agree with everything that John Wesley's done, but he's done just some pretty incredible work. I'm going to be pretty honest with you. He lived about 85 years back in the 17th century, born in the early 1700s, died in the late 1700s. He was involved with the Church of England. His dad was a minister for the Church of England. He went to college at Lincoln College and went back as a professor. Did some great preaching, some great sermons can be read by that were preached by John Wesley. John could not preach in our society today because just by reading his sermons, you got to figure you were there for an hour and a half. And so he wouldn't make it with a single church in the world today. He'd be unemployed. But I'm telling you some good, really good stuff. And one of the concepts that he hit on was the doctrine of perfection. And he carried that doctrine too far in the long run. He messed it up in his later years. But in his early years, in this doctrine of perfection kind of mentality, he asserted that we are not perfect, but we are perfect. That we are not perfect. In other words, we're not so perfect that we can know the entire mind of God. We're not so perfect that we can understand all the origins of the universe. We're not so perfect that we're not prone to mistakes of interpretation of Scripture. But then on the other hand, we are so perfect. We are so blasted perfect. And he asserts, and I think rightly so, that the more that we know God, the more that we study God's Word, the greater our perfection becomes. Because for the fellow who's a new creature, this concept that we were just talking about, for the fellow who's a new creature, right? For the fellow who's been born again, the more that he understands of God's Word and God's demands and God's desires, it should become more and more impossible for us to violate that which we know. Have you ever thought about that? Have you ever thought about that? That as we become more and more knowledgeable about God and God's requirements on our lives and how God would like for us to obey, it should, for the fellow who are new creatures, new birthed individuals, it should become increasingly more difficult, almost to the point of impossibility, of violating that which we know God would have us do. And so he says to these people here, I want you to consecrate yourself. Do you think these people know the law? Do they know the law? The last thing Moses did before he left this earth, pull them over the side and do what? Read them the law again. These people know the law. And so God's saying to these people, or he's having Joshua say to these people, wash away that holiness, push it away. Get holy. Get righteous. That's a good thing, because if they get across the Jordan, wherever they put their foot, what happens? What does it say? They own the land, don't they? They own the land. I mean, if they get across the Jordan, every place they place their foot, it's their land. And so he says, consecrate yourself. Push that holiness out. Now, brethren, in a metaphor here, I'm just telling you that consecration will allow us that no matter where we put our foot, we will own victory. You believe that? No. I didn't. No. Don't just shake your head at me. Do you believe that? And do you live like you believe that? Yeah. Do you believe like you live that? So he says, consecrate yourself. And the second thing he says, if you do, God will do amazing things. God will do the unbelievable. Now, I don't think that's just an Old Testament concept, do you? I don't think that's an Old Testament concept, do you? That God will do the unbelievable. Now, God doesn't do the unbelievable for me for a lot of reasons. One is because I have my own agenda. And I'm trying to get God to get on my agenda. I'm just being honest with you here. I didn't come up with this so I could preach at you today. I'm telling you that I've come to the determination that the reason God does not do unbelievable things for me is because I'm working God on my agenda. I've got retirement to think about. I've got a career I've got to manage. You know, I've got family items I've got to take care of. And I'm just telling you that I've got an agenda and I'm trying to get God on my agenda. And that's probably a bit problematic to Him. It's problematic to me because he won't conform, but I bet it's a bigger problem to him than it is to me. And another reason that God's not able to do really stupendous things, supernatural things, unbelievable things for me on occasion is because of my abilities. I mean, really, I've got 3 degrees. Did you know that? I'm educated. I've got 25 or 30 years of experience in the business world with some top-notch corporations. I've got experience out here. I mean, I got a lot of good stuff going for me. But you know what? Because I have these abilities, I tend to count on my abilities, right? and not so much on his. So he won't get on my agenda. He's given me these abilities. It's probably made me more trustworthy in my abilities than his. And then there is this element, and this is what I mentioned earlier that I want to spend just a minute on. There is this element of anxiety, right? There is an element of anxiety. If I allow God to take me where He wants to lead me, that could be a bit threatening, couldn't it? That could be a bit scary, right? Couldn't it? I mean, to be totally submissive to my wife? What was Ken thinking when he thought of that? Because that's a little scary just to take the walls down and let it roll, right? It's a little scary. You know, treat others exactly like I'd like to be treated in each and every instance. I don't think that's right. These people are not going to reciprocate. So it creates in me some anxiety, right? Brethren, God's never going to be able to do what God wants to do in unbelievable ways until I get off my agenda, until I get over my abilities, until I reduce my anxiety. It's never going to happen. And how do we do that? Well, one thing we do is through His Word, right? His Word will never lie to us. It will never mislead us, right? Faith comes by hearing, hearing by the Word of God. So one thing to do to get all those other things out of the way, my agenda out of the way, and so on and so forth, and find what His agenda is and what His abilities are and why I don't need to be anxious, one thing would be to get in His Word. The second thing, though, would realize God's time and place, right? Now, God's time and place doesn't always match up with exactly what we'd like to see going on in our lives. Where's my good brother Carl at? Carl here's got a little bit of a health problem. It's probably not the best time or place for that problem to exist. But I bet it is stretching your faith just a little bit. And it's better to get in tune with God's time and place. Be highly sensitive to what He might be doing about building faith or testing me or whatever that is, rather than me worrying about other things. Another thing is God's people, right? Somehow or another, God's created this group of people right here. All of us right here. And we're all in love with the same God, and that makes us in love with each other. And you guys have totally unique, different gifts and abilities, right? And God's allowed us to intersect with each other to help us figure out about our faith and what we should be doing and what we should be thinking and who we should be praying for. He's allowed that. And then, you know, I can get over my own agenda and my anxiety and so on and so forth if I get with God's action, right? You only have two choices. You're on the sidelines saying, I sure wish God would do something. That's one option. And because we think that God's not doing what He needs to do, a lot of us practice that option. We sit on the sidelines and we think, boy, I sure wish God would get after it. The other side of that coin would be to realizing that God already has an action in place and He is doing something. And maybe it would be a good thing if we got on board. Just a thought. Maybe we ought to just get on board. Because with His Word, and His time and place, and His people, and His action, I know that God will give His provision, right? He'll give us whatever I need to make that happen. He's not going to short me. God's not in the business of shorting me. He's in the business of doing every good thing that I allow Him to do for me. That's the business He's in. So God, I'm just persuaded that God can do marvelous things for us. But He may not be able to do marvelous things for us in the context that we decide to live our lives or the context that this congregation decides to live their lives. But I don't think that we ought not think that God can't do amazing things if we consecrate ourselves and let Him lead. Now we've got to speed up. I'm in verse 7. The Lord said to Joshua today, well, let me read verse 6 and then we'll pick it up. Joshua said to the priest, take up the Ark of the Covenant and pass ahead of the people. So they took it up and went out ahead of them. And the Lord said to Joshua, today I begin to exalt you in the eyes of all of Israel so they'll know that I'm with you. And I was with Moses. Tell the priest who carry the Ark of the Covenant, when you reach the edge of Jordan's River, go and stand in the water. Stand in the river. Brethren, faith takes stepping out. Faith takes a step for you to do something. If you're waiting on me before you get right, You may have to wait forever because I am rebellious and sometimes I am a heathen. And it's better for you to watch the Lord and just get to the river and get in the water. I don't care how wide it is, and I'm not even concerned, especially not concerned, about what your particular hurdles are, because I know that my God is able to do abundantly above more than what you and I even expect or believe. And that happens to be Ephesians chapter 3 and verse 20. So I got book, chapter, and verse that He is able to do exceedingly more than anything that you expect. And so the best thing for us to do is just get in the water. Just get in the water. Let's just move on. Just get to the edge of the river and get in the water. Verse 9. Joshua said to the Israelites, "Come here and listen to the words of the Lord, your God. This is how you will know that the living God is among you and that He will certainly drive out before you." And boy, here we go, the Hittites and the Tites. The Canaanites, the Hittites, the Hivites, the Perizzites, the Jerizzites, Amorites, and Jebusites. "See the ark of the covenant of the Lord of all the earth who will go into the Jordan ahead of you. Now then, choose 12 men from the tribes of Israel, one from each tribe, and as soon as these priests who carry the ark of the Lord of all the earth," the Lord of all the earth, that ark, the ark that belongs to the Lord who is the Lord of all of the earth, "set foot in the Jordan, its waters flowing downstream will be cut off, and they'll stand up in a heap." And that happened 16 miles to the north at a little village called Adam. Cut off the waters, stood up in a heap so these people could get across the land. Now I'm going to tell you about faith. Faith requires us to get on with these opportunities that God provides us, because, brethren, opportunities can be rejected, right? Did you notice the list of the tribes that are going to be destroyed? Did you notice that? The ones I can't pronounce, did you notice that? Why are they going to be destroyed? Can't hear you. Why are they going to be destroyed? Huh? Sin, and do they have knowledge of God? I have a chapter, a verse in second chapter of Joshua of a prostitute named Rahab. Was she a believer? She heard and she believed. These tribes here chose not to. So brethren, faith and opportunity can be rejected. It can be. And it's assured the fate because it's going to end in destruction. That's what the book says. God says, "I'm going to take care of these people because I'm the God of all the earth." Very last section here real quick. So that when the people broke camp, I wrote something there. I can't read that next word. So when the people broke camp, I've got to quit writing in my Bible. So when the people broke camp to pass the Jordan, the priests carrying the Ark of the Covenant went ahead of them. Now the Jordan is at flood stage all during harvest. Yet as soon as all the priests who carried the Ark reached the Jordan and their feet touched the water's edge, the water from upstream stopped flowing. It piled up a heap a great distance away in a town called Adam in the vicinity of Sarethan. While the water flowing down to the Sea of the Arabah, the Salt Sea, was completely cut off. When God does great things, He does great things. The water was completely cut off. So the people crossed over opposite Jericho, 20 miles south of where that ford came in at. The priest who carried the Ark of the Covenant of the Lord stood firm on dry ground in the middle of the Jordan while all of Israel passed by, until the whole nation, all 2.5 million people, and all the cows and the sheep and the goats and the oxen and all the personal possessions and everything they owned and everything they ever hoped to own, till the whole nation had completed the crossing on dry ground. On dry ground. That's what faith does. That's what faith does. Faith gets you out of the mud, and faith gets you away from saying, "I don't think we can get across." It gets you across on dry ground. I got to go to Romans chapter 4. Give me 1 minute. I promise, no more. Well, I'll have to repent tonight if I make that promise. So I'm not going to make that promise. Romans chapter 4. You read the whole text. You need to read. If you haven't read chapter 4 in a while, you need to read Romans chapter 4. You need to do it sooner than later. But it talks about the whole deal about Abraham and his faith. But I only want to focus on one piece here. And I want to encourage you. Here's where I want to finish at. I want to encourage you, and I want you to challenge me, and I want us to challenge each other. And I want us to begin to pray about this. And I want us to begin to pray every day about this. And I don't care if you don't pray about anything else, but I want you to pray about this. I want to encourage you and ask you to begin to pray about this. And I want you to do that for this congregation. And if you're not going to pray for yourself, I want you to pray for me. If you choose not to pray for yourself, that's okay. But I'm going to ask you to pray for me. And I want you to know that I'm going to fervently pray for you. Every time I think about it, it may not be every day, but I'm going to try to be very conscientious, very aware that we need to begin to pray for greater faith. We need to ask God for greater faith. We don't need to assume that we've arrived, which I think we sometimes think that. I want us to begin to believe that we have not arrived, and I want us to begin to pray that God will increase our faith to the point of Abraham's faith. Now read with me Romans chapter 4 and about verse 18. And here's where I want us to go with our faith. It says, against all hope, what you can't even imagine might happen. Against all hope, Abraham in hope believed. And so he became the father of many nations. Just as it had been said to him, so shall your offspring be. Without weakening his faith, he faced the fact that his body was what? As good as dead. He faced the fact, as good as dead. Since he was about 100 years old, and that Sarah's womb, why, it was also dead. Yet, he did not waver through unbelief. He just didn't waver through unbelief regarding the promise of God. Let's begin to pray that we do not waver. That we do not waver in unbelief. And know that we have the promise of God, who wants to do far more, exceedingly more than what you and I have in our mind's ability to even imagine. Boy, I just love Joshua and his children. And more than that, I just love the Jehovah they serve who can carry us over Jordan. Thank you. We'll see you next week.